Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. For God and my country. Surely this could be a fitting motto for a priest who is called to serve as a military chaplain, who, unarmed, faces conflicts alongside those with and for whom he works, those who are prepared to lay down their own lives on behalf of other people and causes, often on foreign soil. In today's programme we hear from the newly appointed Principal Catholic Chaplain to Britain's Royal Air Force. As we look towards November and the month when we pray in a special way for those who have died, we reflect on what might happen to babies who die without baptism. As we hear from the leader of the Theological Commission, who prepared the recent document on limbo, we have reason to hope that these little ones are with God. But first, Chris Altieri now reminds us of the Pope's message from today's general audience.
From the English News Desk, I'm Chris Altieri. Pope Benedict XVI today held his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square. The grey, threatening, drizzly sky did not dissuade the many thousands of pilgrim faithful who came to see and hear the Holy Father discuss St. Maximus of Turin.
We meet Maximus as Bishop of Turin in 319-1908, a year after the death of Ambrose. It was a time of growing civil unrest when Turin had become a center of refuge for those fleeing before the barbarian invaders. His homilies reflect a growing awareness of the responsibility of Christians to promote a just social order grounded in solidarity with the poor. Addressed specifically to the wealthy, the homilies inculcate concern for those in need, readiness to sacrifice for the common good, and commitment to public service.
Pope Benedict continued to say Maximus was one among many bishops of his time who found themselves called upon to take on greater civil authority and responsibility.
His example and teaching remind us that whatever the age in which they live, Christian believers are called upon to carry out faithfully their duties as citizens, working to imbue temporal society with the spirit of the gospel, and striving to achieve a vital synthesis between their duties as citizens of the earthly city and their commitment to work for the coming of God's kingdom of holiness, justice, and peace.
The Holy Father had special words of greeting for the Sisters of the Resurrection, who were in Rome for the beatification of their foundress, Mother Celine Kluczynska-Borzeska, which took place last week.
I warmly greet the Sisters of the Resurrection present in Rome for the beatification of the foundress, Mother Celine Kluczynska-Borzeska. May the Lord grant them the grace of following generously in her footsteps.
Following her beatification, Pope Benedict praised Blessed Mother Celina as an example of Christian martyrdom in ordinary life. I'm Chris Altieri.
Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini,
qui feci celum et terra,
benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
Amen.
What happens if a baby dies without baptism? This is not a theoretical question. It is one with a burning significance to parents who have lost their baby through miscarriage or shortly after birth, to women who have aborted their baby and have come to regret it. Where is my baby? This was the subject for profound reflection by the Church's Theological Commission. For many years the concept of limbo was postulated, but a Salesian theologian, Father Dominic Veliath, who headed the Theological Commission's committee responsible for writing up their document on limbo, declares, "We have a strong reason to hope that these little babies are with God." There is hope. Across the centuries and in every country, culture and tradition, there have been families hit by the devastating pain of losing a baby. It is a pain unlike any other, an agony that some families never succeed in fully accepting. For the rest of their lives, even when a clear medical reason might exist, there is the question, why? Why me, Lord? Why us? Why our baby? Even if parents never had the opportunity to meet their baby, they establish a relationship with it, following its every movement, even in the womb. They cannot conceive of losing even that slender contact with their child. It is, therefore, inevitable that for Christians, for whom baptism is essential, they have asked, "What has happened to my baby?" They have intellectually wondered if that baby is in limbo, but in their hearts have spoken of having our own little angel in heaven. Abortion is one of today's evils. It is always a tragedy. There is often enormous grief after the event, an event that is final and cannot be undone. Again, there is the question, what has happened to the baby? This baby never had a chance to be baptized, never had a chance to know right and wrong before it became the innocent victim. Father Dominic Veliath, a Salesian theologian, was part of the theological commission convened to consider what happens to unbaptized babies when they die. He headed the subcommittee which drafted the response. He explains further.
This issue, and it's not particularly on limbo, but on the salvation of unbaptized infants, well, that was one of the themes which was entrusted to the discussion of the International Theological Commission by our late Holy Father, Pope John Paul II. And by last December, the work was finished. He submitted it to the Holy Father, and the Holy Father approved the text for publication.
The document is called The Hope of Salvation for Infants Who Die Without Being Baptized. It is divided into an introduction in three parts. The whole focus of the document is not on limbo, but on the hope of salvation for unbaptized infants.
The issue is this. The church knows that, okay, as far as an adult is concerned, endowed as he or she is with reason, consciousness and freedom, in a sense, he responds to God's salvation offered him through his freedom, either accepts it or rejects it. In the case of a baptized infant, there's a sacrament of baptism there. But what about these unbaptized infants? Where do we situate them? On the one hand, they have not rejected the grace of God. But on the other hand, how do you situate them? And it's in this context that when we go through the history of theology, we come up with a lot of problems. And it's in that light the document was studied.
The question of salvation for unbaptized babies has a long history. There is the need to balance sinfulness, the need for baptism, and God's will for all people to be saved. The idea of limbo is comparatively recent, as Father Dominic explains.
The Greek fathers never had this problem of limbo. Instead, you find this in the Latin fathers. But once you come to the Second Vatican Council, there's the awareness, the sense of the faith of the church, which looks at things from a different perspective.
Limbo is not and never has been an article of faith.
The different ways of understanding limbo, that pertains to only different theological opinions.
Father Dominic points out that the documents of the Second Vatican Council stressed that one of the most important truths of our faith is that God wants the universal salvation of all people.
This is realized through Christ in the Spirit. And then you have, there is need for the church, there is need for sacramental baptism. So you see a certain openness in the fact that God wants all people to be saved. But on the other hand, we do need the church, do need baptism.
There appears to be a certain theological openness regarding the situation of unbaptized babies when sinfulness, the necessity of baptism, and membership of the church are considered.
We find in the second chapter a long-standing tradition, the faith, common doctrine, and theological opinion, that they seem to be to favor the salvation.
There is hope. The document concludes that there are good reasons for hope.
We do not have any revelation in this regard. And so, technically speaking, what we call limbo remains a possible theological hypothesis. But there are good reasons to hope for the salvation of these unbaptized infants. And it'll spell them out. For instance, signs of the times. For instance, there's a whole world is coming together, this concern for children, and Vatican II. Gaudium et Spes will speak about reading the signs of the times. Secondly, to speak about God's merciful philanthropy, God's providence, God's love touches every human being. Then solidarity with Christ. And Christ's grace is far greater than sin. Where sin abounded, grace superabounds. And the need for the church and as communion, communion aspect of the church, and this need for hope. Reading all these signs, what does the document conclude? The document doesn't conclude that we have any new revelation. We do not have any new revelation. The document concludes there are good reasons for hope that God will save infants when we have not been able to do for them what we would have wished to do, namely to baptize them to the faith of the church.
During the month of November, we not only remember our loved ones who have died in times of peace. Many countries across the world also remember those who have died in battle, often far from their homes and families. Today, the military are often engaged not in war, but in peacekeeping ventures which have their own important considerations. They need someone who is prepared to be alongside them as they face unknown and potentially life-threatening situations, or who might just be feeling homesick and concerned for the folks back home. Throughout the centuries, there have been chaplains who have been ready and willing to be that person. Unarmed, and yet facing the same conditions as their armed comrades, the essential role of a military chaplain is often unseen by the rest of the world. Monsignor John Michael Walsh has just been appointed the principal Catholic chaplain to Britain's Royal Air Force, and has been made Vicar General to the Bishopric of the Forces. We now hear from someone whose motto could well be, "For God and my country."
What has happened is this. The Royal Air Force appoints principal chaplains of the major sending churches. In our case, the previous principal chaplain, Roman Catholic, to the Royal Air Force, resigned several weeks ago. And the process of selection of a successor then commenced.
At a time when the Church is repeatedly speaking of the importance of the role of the military chaplain, Monsignor John Michael Walsh has just been appointed as both the principal Catholic chaplain to Britain's Royal Air Force and as a Vicar General in the Bishopric of the Forces. This is the diocese responsible for the pastoral care of all those who serve in the British Armed Forces. Monsignor Walsh continues, describing what happened with his own selection process as the principal chaplain to the Royal Air Force.
I've been in the Royal Air Force now for 4 years and 9 months. So I'm very much the new kid on the block, still in the Royal Air Force to some degree, and as the new principal chaplain and Vicar General. I'm now in the Silver Jubilee year of my ordination. I'll have been ordained a priest 25 years next July. So I'm certainly not the new boy on the block when it comes to the priesthood.
But I would imagine that being a chaplain for the military, whatever branch, It certainly stands you in good stead to have had experience as a priest.
Well, certainly the age profile of ministers of religion joining the military, and certainly this is true of the Royal Air Force, is higher now than it's ever been. This reflects a number of things. First of all, the later age of ordinance, reaching ordination. And secondly, the fact that people are wanting more experience in their diocesan ministry before coming into a specialized ministry like military chaplaincy. And I think that we are benefiting from that rich and varied experience of candidates who offer themselves for military training and military chaplaincy service.
But I would imagine as well that when you are military, inevitably you're going to be involved to some extent with combat situations, and a maturity within your own practice of the priesthood must be a considerable help to the people with whom you'll be working.
Well, there is no doubt that military chaplaincy now is involving itself directly in areas of conflict. This has mostly been the case in the history of military chaplaincy, but certainly at the moment in Iraq and Afghanistan, chaplains are very much involved in the conflict there in terms of ministry to armed forces personnel engaged in those conflicts. I think that anyone coming into Royal Air Force chaplaincy, for example, has to think very carefully about being involved in armed conflict, ministering to those in the war situation itself. It's a very difficult thing to come to terms with, and it's something that you have to really clarify in your own mind before you offer yourself a service. It's a great privilege and a great honor to be alongside men and women who are really prepared to lay down their lives for their country, to minister to them, to encourage them, and to be alongside them. And they certainly want chaplains there. The demands for chaplaincy in these particular areas of operation have increased over the last 2 or 3 years, and we're finding ourselves going out now more and more often for periods of engagement between 2 and 4 months at a time. So you're certainly right. Part of the process of discerning a vocation to the military is taking into account the very likely possibility of ministering in areas of conflict. Your maturity of priestly service will serve you in those areas with a certain confidence and a certain robustness of ministry that's necessary.
Yes, because you'll be with people in conflict, but you yourself will be unarmed.
That's correct. We are unarmed. We do not carry arms. And we go in there as ministers of religion, as ministers of God, to support and encourage, to administer the sacraments, to stand alongside. But we remain vulnerable. And, of course, that's something that we take into account when we go into these places of danger. Everyone in theatres of operation is vulnerable in some way. The chaplain, perhaps more than most. But we have tremendous support and protection from those around us. Those around us take their chaplains very much to heart, look after us very well, and keep us well away from danger. So we're very blessed in that regard.
And very brave.
Well, I think a certain degree of courage is needed. It's not quite like the situation in the First and Second World Wars, where chaplains were literally at risk of their lives on the battlefield and in other places, where we lost many chaplains in both world wars who laid down their lives to serve their people, to serve soldiers, sailors and airmen. But certainly, yes, you need a degree of courage, because when you get on that aircraft to go overseas to theatres of operation, you're not really sure what's going to happen. And there has to be a depth of faith in placing yourself into the hand of God, knowing that he will protect you, but that ultimately you pray that his will be done in your life. But you know that you're going to serve through your life, through your priestly ministry, those who are also prepared to lay down their lives for their country.
Which is tremendous generosity.
I think it requires great generosity. Certainly to be a priest today demands great generosity and great faith, to know that the priesthood is never just a job or a career, but is a sacred calling from God. It is a calling to serve, and to lay down one's life if necessary, but certainly to serve generously. And military ministry, likewise, in some ways crystallizes that generosity, that demand upon you. It's a great honor and a great blessing. And I think for this reason, military ministry as a priest is a great blessing. It really strengthens your priesthood, deepens it, and gives it even greater meaning.
And which countries have you been in since you've been with the RAF?
I've been to many countries in my time in the RAF. I've been overseas to the United States, to the Azores. I've been to the Arctic Circle and to Norway. I've been out to Cyprus and then out to the Middle East. I've been out to Bahrain. I've been down to the states of Qatar and also to Oman. And recently I was there for 2 months. I've also transited through Iraq very briefly on the way home and had the chance for several hours to see the Basra air station, where our airmen are, where our soldiers are, and where the chaplains are that serve them. And although that was only a very brief visit indeed, it was enough time to see the tremendous work that's done there and the courage of the people who serve there. So I've been fortunate to have traveled extensively since I joined and to have been on operation twice now. The first time for a month and the second for 2 months earlier this year.
Taking a non-combat area for comparison, if you're in, say, the Arctic or the Middle East, is your role as a chaplain the same, or is it different apart from the temperature?
Well, the temperature is certainly very different. You come to two extremes. I think in the Arctic Circle, when I was up there briefly with one of our transport crews that were flying from Bryce Norton, the temperature was around minus 20 degrees. In the Gulf states, you could have 40 to 50 degrees plus that you're ministering in. And that can certainly be a great challenge. Either can be a great challenge. But the type of ministry you're involved in is very varied. When I went to the Arctic Circle, I went with the air crew, so I would be up in the cockpit on the flight deck watching the flight itself happening, talking to the air crew, talking to the loadmaster at the back of the aircraft, being there when people would come on board to unload the equipment and send the jet away. When you're out in areas of operations, theater of operation, you're very much the chaplain for everyone. So you're traveling around frequently to all the different sections and all the different people. And you're doing that regularly every day to show your faith and to make it clear that you're everyone's friend. You're accessible to all. And people generally, I'm glad to say, react with a smile when the padre walks through the door, often offering you a cup of tea. Sit down, let's have a chat. And they rely on you to have that sense of humor, that robust sense of humor that keeps everyone cheerful, even to the point of taking a few bags of sweets around with you as well. Everyone likes to have a few sweets and likes to see the padre just coming in with a little gift now and again.
Well, it must be an enriching experience for you as well to be with people in those very widely different situations and to be able to see the grandeur of the different landscapes, because I'm thinking, for instance, of going into the Arctic Circle and seeing these fantastic places that most of us will only see on television, and then going into the Middle East and perhaps seeing desert areas.
Yes, the landscapes are wonderful. The trip to the Arctic Circle was very memorable because of the Aurora Borealis that we saw, the Northern Lights. We were flying at about 30,000 feet, so we got a very clear view of them, and that was an awe-inspiring moment to see that close up and very clearly. And then to land in a blizzard and take off in a blizzard, and we weren't sure whether we were going to be able to get the aircraft out because the blizzard was so severe. So certainly a slight thrill of risk there, if you like, wondering if we were ever going to get out or whether we'd be grounded for several days. In the Middle East, my clearest memory and most inspiring memory was of some years ago when we were transiting in a VC-10 aircraft over to Bahrain, and we were accompanying two GR4 aircraft. We were refueling them on the way, and we had to fly low, about 18,000, 19,000 feet, because the fighter jets can't fly much higher than that. And we were being routed over the Sinai Desert, and we flew alongside Mount Sinai and down across the Red Sea, looking, having a wonderful panorama of the very likely route that the people of Israel took from Egypt, from slavery to the Promised Land, and possibly the crossing where the Red Sea parted, all of that rich with biblical history. And I was able to explain it on the flight deck, the geography, the biblical geography around us. And it was a wonderful moment. People were really taken aback, and they remembered their Bible stories, and it was a moment of real evangelization and of deep memories for me. So yes, you're right, landscapes come in all shapes and sizes, but many of them are inspiring.
And going back to the bishopric of the armed forces, you've got principal chaplains not only for the Royal Air Force, but for the Navy and for the Army. How do you work together?
Well, that's right. We have three principal chaplains in the bishopric of the forces, one for each of the services, the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force. All three of us are vicars general of the Bishop to the Forces, Bishop Tom Burns. We form the Episcopal Council as his vicars general, and we work together primarily as priests, also as consultors to the bishop. So the bishop will consult us very frequently, both individually and as a group in that Episcopal Council. We're also military chaplains, so although we're in different services, we serve broadly the same aims. We have the same kind of experiences, concerns, anxieties, and joys, and we bring them together in individual conversations very frequently. You'll find the vicars general will be in touch with each other very often, both to seek advice, to consult, and simply to find support from one another. And also, we're in very regular contact with Bishop Tom Burns. Bishop Burns is excellent at consulting his vicars general regularly, and likes to keep the lines of communication frequently open. And that, of course, as you know, sister, is the primary responsibility of a vicar general, to be the alter ego to the bishop, and to be close to him, his closest collaborator, if you like. So we're very honoured to hold that position.
Well, God bless you. And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.